Sorry, we're in Numbers chapter 10. Mr. David was helping us out last time, so yeah. How about we start with a prayer, and then we will jump into our study together. Elijah, would you mind leading us in a prayer, please?
Sure. Father in heaven, thank you for the time we're able to come together to study your word and to encourage each other and serve you. Help us to learn good things from your word. Help us to learn things that we can use in our everyday lives.
Amen. Amen. All right, so I'm going to ask you just for some review. We've got these three major sections in Numbers. Now, by the way, there are a lot of different ways to outline Numbers, and Numbers is not in chronological order. I think we talked about that before. If you look at Numbers 10, verse 11, it's the second year in the second month. But then there's some other places where it goes back before that. So it's not in chronological order. I think there's some good reason for that. I don't know. Did David talk through that some with you last time? He shared some notes with me. I think he was intending to get into that. There's some really interesting ideas about why the chapters are in the order that they're in. And it may be that the focus is really all on the tabernacle. And that makes sense. When you think of Numbers, maybe you're thinking of the camp, maybe you're thinking of the people and the generations. But the focus of the camp is the tabernacle. And why is the tabernacle in the middle of the camp? What are some reasons? Amos? Yeah, so God is wanting to be accessible to all of his people. There's also maybe a military perspective here where it's protecting the tabernacle from outsiders, but it's also protecting the tabernacle. So even though God's in the midst of the people, he wants to be near everyone. Who is directly camping around the tabernacle? Do you remember?
Levites.
And their job is to protect the people from the tabernacle, which is kind of weird. Why would they need to protect the people from the tabernacle? Lyndon? God is holy. Now, the people are supposed to be holy too. We saw in Leviticus how they're supposed to be taught to do God's will. But there's just this challenge, this tension between drawing near to God and needing to be kept from him to some distance because he's a holy God. So I think there's some of that on display in the structure. Some of it's over my head. Some of it's just as a challenge. So I would encourage you to think through that. There's some resources that David or I could point you to. David Rafe, I'm sorry, could point you to. But today we're going to kind of take it slow, and we're going to start walking through Numbers 10, beginning in verse 11. My aim is to get through chapter 12, but we'll see. Okay, we're just going to kind of walk through the text. So let's begin reading in Numbers 10. Verses 11 through 36. In the second year, in the second month, on the 20th day of the month, the cloud lifted from over the tabernacle of the testimony. And the people of Israel set out by stages from the wilderness of Sinai, and the cloud settled down in the wilderness of Paran. They set out for the first time at the command of the Lord by Moses. The standard of the camp of the people of Judah set out first by their companies. And over their company was Nashon, the son of Amminadab. And over the company of the tribe of the people of Issachar was Nethaneel, the son of Zuar. And over the company of the tribe of the people of Zebulun was Eliab, the son of Helon. And when the tabernacle was taken down, the sons of Gershon and the sons of Merari, who carried the tabernacle, set out. And the standard of the camp of Reuben set out by their companies. And over their company was Elizur, the son of Shedeur. And over the company of the tribe of the people of Simeon was Shelumiel, the son of Zerishaddai. And over the company of the tribe of the people of Gad was Eliasaph, the son of Deuel. Then the Kohathites set out, carrying the holy things, and the tabernacle was set up before their arrival. And the standard of the camp of the people of Ephraim set out by their companies. And over their company was Elishama, the son of Ammihud. And over the company of the tribe of the people of Manasseh was Gamaliel, the son of Pedahazar. And over the company of the tribe of the people of Benjamin was Abidan, the son of Gideoni. Then the standard of the camp of the people of Dan, acting as the rear guard of all the camps set out by their companies. And over their company was Ahazer, the son of Amishadai. And over the company of the tribe of the people of Asher was Pagiel, the son of Ochran. And over the company of the tribe of the people of Naphtali was Ahira, the son of Enan. This was the order of march of the people of Israel by their companies when they set out. And Moses said to Hobab, the son of Reuel, the Midianite, Moses' father-in-law, "We are setting out for the place of which the Lord said, 'I will give it to you.' Come with us, and we will do good to you, for the Lord has promised good to Israel." But he said to him, "I will not go. I will depart to go to my own land and to my kindred." And he said, "Please do not leave us, for you know where we should camp in the wilderness, and you will serve as eyes for us. And if you do go with us, whatever good the Lord will do to us, the same will we do to you." So they set out from the mount of the Lord, 3 days' journey, and the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord went before them 3 days' journey to seek out a resting place for them. And the cloud of the Lord was over them by day whenever they set out from the camp. And whenever the Ark set out, Moses said, "Arise, O Lord, and let your enemies be scattered, and let those who hate you flee before you." And when it rested, he said, "Return, O Lord, to the 10,000s of Israel." All right, so really kind of an exciting time. May not seem exciting just in reading all these names and all these clans and tribes and peoples. But imagine being an Israelite and you've been organized for the first time and you're setting out, and you're not just setting out as a people, but you're taking with you the tabernacle. And so you'd have the Ark of the Covenant being carried by the high priest. I think that's what verses 33 and 34 are saying, is when the cloud lifted up, the priests would ready the Ark of the Covenant. They would actually take the veil from the tabernacle and then wrap the Ark of the Covenant with it, and the priests would carry it. I don't think this means they're carrying it 3 days away and then they follow. But the idea is for 3 days they're making their way. So the Ark of the Covenant is leading the way, and then Judah, you know, their company is going to set out. And then Gershon and Merari, they're going to take the rest of the tabernacle and they're going to get it set up. The very first thing to touch down will be the Ark of the Covenant. The tabernacle set up all around it. You remove the veil, pull it up around, and then the rest of the furniture would come along behind. Okay, I'm calling it furniture. Like, it's not a couch and a duvet and all that stuff. What's a duvet? Anyway, but you know, all of the implements going into the tabernacle. So we're into this traveling stage, and the people are going with purpose. The story of the Exodus doesn't end with the Red Sea. It really meets its moment at Sinai. And I think that's so important because have you ever seen Charlton Heston and Cecil B. DeMille, the Ten Commandments, the classic? I think it comes on TV every year, like Easter time. You seen this movie? Surely. Or like The Prince of Egypt. Please don't tell me you saw the Christian Bale. Like, they're all about like crossing the Red Sea, and then that's, ta-da, we won. We're just getting started. So get to Sinai and the tabernacle, and it's a celebration of the covenant relationship with God. All the things that are happening here, God didn't save them just to get them out of Egypt. He didn't save them, and we'll make this point some more today. He didn't save them to get them away from slavery. It's very important. He's actually giving them a new master. They're going to be new servants of this new relationship, but they're coming in as conquerors. So they're marching out with this new purpose. It's not away from slavery. Now it's toward victory. Let me pause there. As you think about that process for the people of Israel, how does that translate to us today? Can you think of any significance for us today with that kind of image of Israel's story?
What?
Go ahead.
Right. Do your thing, we have a new master. Like, we choose this relationship with Christ, and he is who we are following.
Yeah, Romans 6 makes that point, right? Galatians 5, and make sure that your freedom doesn't devour you. So Romans 6 is you're no longer enslaved to sin, but you are servants of righteousness leading to sanctification and eternal life. Okay, so we're not just, all right, now I can do whatever I want to. And I think that a lot of people have latched on to the Exodus story because they think the story is about freedom. It's not about freedom. Like, slavery is bad, but it's bad because you choose the wrong master. Okay? And so here God is giving them a new relationship. Lynn, you had a
hand. I was just thinking about all of the descriptions of, like, groaning under bondage, whereas there is liberty and freedom under the service of God.
Yes. Yeah. Jesus says, if the Son makes you free, you'll be free indeed. So there is freedom in voluntary service. Okay? God's asking them if they want this relationship. What else? When you're removed from sin, it's not just the Christian's goal is not just to keep from sin. The Christian's goal is to conquer. The Christian's aim is to go where Christ went. And so we've got to move forward with conviction, with faith, with courage, and not just with fear that I'm going to fall back into sin. You've got bigger things to do than just to keep from sin. Like, that's really important. But you've got to move on and start leading others and taking others with you and teaching the next generation to follow the Lord. So this is all about celebrating the covenant relationship and trusting God and going forth into new land. Okay, that's end of Matthew 28, right? Jesus says, go into all the world. He doesn't say, make sure you don't sin. That's a given. You're freed from that. But now what's the next step? Okay. So there's more to process there, but I mean, this is really relevant to us today. Now, what else do you notice through this section? I mean, it's just kind of the basics of marching out, but does anything else catch your eye in what we read 11 through 36? Numbers 10, 11 through 36. Elijah?
So, down in verse 31 and 32, it talks about how it talks about you're going to know where we should camp. I thought they were following God's cloud.
Okay. I was wondering if that was going to come up. So who's leading them? Is Hobab going to be scout for them and help them find a place to camp? Or is God in the cloud leading them? Lindsay's nodding her head. It wasn't either or question, but I think the answer is yes. God is going to be setting them up a 3 days journey away. And it seems that between here and there, God is going to be using Hobab and his people, the Midianites, as this scouting group. They're not Midianites, but they're of Midian. So they're Midianites. But they're going to be using them as a scouting group to get them to that location. Does God use human means to lead his people in a divine way? We're studying Luke on Thursday nights, and kind of an interesting thing. Is Luke inspired to write the Gospel of Luke? Sure he is. But you know what he says in the first few verses of Luke is, did my research. So it's interesting to see that God uses these human means in a divine way to get his people where they need to be.
I guess I always thought about it being, like, this is such a huge mass of people, and you would know better than I, there's topography of the land. There are places that would be good for people to camp and places that wouldn't. So even though God may be going and saying, like, this is the direction we're going to go, you still need to choose where you're going to be putting your tents and where you're
sure.
Where is a safe and secure.
They'll need access to water.
Right. So that's kind of how I imagine some of that.
Yeah, that's part of this, is God's going to be using Hobab to guide them through this territory. Yeah. All right. What else do you notice through this section? Anything else?
Well, I'm just curious about verses 29 through 32 and this kind of interaction with Moses' brother-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
And what that's about. Like, why are we needing to know about him convincing Hobab to go with them?
That's a good question. Why should it even be important to us that we know that the descendants of Reuel make their way with Moses and the Israelites? They're going to show up later in the story. Later in fact, the prophet Jeremiah. There are going to be some players here, and you go, like, well, why are they there? And this is just a little breadcrumb for us that we can trace back and see, oh, that's where they came from. The Israelite people are not just Israelites. Okay, this whole camp is not just going to be Israelites. And we're going to see that in this next section where there are some of the rabble, it's called. I don't know what your translation is going to say in 11:4, but there are some other people that are mixed in. So this is one of those explanations that, you know, you just kind of make note of now and we'll come back to it later. Right? All right, anything else? We're just making our way out. Now, with the pronouncement that Moses makes in 35 through 36, arise, O Lord, let your enemies be scattered. Those who hate you flee before you. Return, O Lord. You see the confession that Moses is making that if God doesn't fight for them, they won't be saved. If God is not with them, they won't be protected. And so this is really all centering around God and his relationship with the people. All right, let's go ahead and look into this next section. There's more to uncover there. We're just kind of hitting high points. But let's read 11, 1 through 3. And David McCauley, would you read that for us, please?
Yep. Mm-hmm. And when the people complained, it displeased the Lord, and the Lord heard it, and his anger was kindled. And the fire of the Lord burnt among them and consumed them that were in the uttermost parts of the camp. And the people cried unto Moses, and when Moses prayed unto the Lord, the fire was quenched. And he called the name of the place Taberah, because the fire of the Lord burnt among them.
All right, so here they are setting out for the first time. Things are going great. In fact, they paused a little while, remember, because they need to take the Passover, allow people a second opportunity to take it because of uncleanness. So they're trying to be a pure people, and how far do they get? They're just starting to complain. What are they complaining about? In verses 1 through 3.
Mine says they're misfortunate.
Now, we're not told specifics, but how does God feel about murmuring and grumbling and complaining? To get a big thumbs down, okay? So parents, this is the story that you tell your children. But do you notice anything interesting about what happens with the punishment for their complaining? How does God correct them? Yeah, there's a fire that comes and it consumes. But who does it consume? There are people who are kind of on the edge of camp. And we made this when we talked about an overview of Numbers. But I'm just going to hit it again. Why the outliers of camp? We're not told. But what's at the middle of the camp? And so there's this focus on the presence of God, and as they're going along and they're complaining and they're grumbling, they're looking away from God. And I'll tell you, that's what happens when we're complaining. We're not trusting God. We're not thinking about the blessing of his presence with us. And maybe if they're looking like, why are we even here? Let's just remove ourselves. Let's get a little further away, a little further away, a little further away. And so God solves that pretty quickly and kind of pulls everybody in. Imagine that you're one of the people camping toward the outside and the fire breaks out all around the camp. Where are you headed? What did you say, Jordan? You're going to go out through the fire? Bad move, man. You're going to go further in, right? And so God is tightening things up here. I think that's really what we're seeing is... When you feel like God's against you and you feel like God has forgotten you, the worst move you can make is away from God. Draw toward him. Worship him. Spend time with him. You read his word. Listen to his voice. And so the people are being drawn closer to this dwelling with God. And they call the place Taberah, meaning burning, because there God had burned them up. So there was this immediate kind of punishment. Nothing deep here. This is just obvious stuff. We're just making some observations, okay? Other thoughts through 1 through 3. All right, then check out Numbers 11, verses 4 through 9. Let's see. Meredith, would you be willing to read that for us?
4 through 9, you said?
Yes, please.
The rabble who were among them had greedy desires, and also the sons of Israel wept again and said, "Who will give us meat to eat? We remember the fish which we used to eat free in Egypt, the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlic. But now our appetite is gone. There's nothing at all to look at except this manna." Now the manna was like coriander seed, and its appearance like that of dahlia. The people would go about and gather it and grind it between two millstones, or beat it in the mortar and boil it in the pot and make cakes with it. And its taste was as the taste of cakes baked with oil. When the dew fell on the camp at night, the manna would fall with it.
All right, thank you. So remember, this is God providing for the people. He's using whatever means necessary, but he's providing for the people bread 6 days a week so that they have plenty on the seventh day. And this was God leading them to trust him. He's testing them. But what do they think about this food?
Boring.
I mean, I don't know. I kind of picture, like, do you remember like the Nature's Valley honey flavored granola bars? Like, that's kind of what I picture here. And it's just like, you know, if you're hungry, it's like, all right, that's pretty good. But if that's all you had to eat, I'd be a little nonplussed, okay? But they're surviving. What are they remembering? Yes. And now, are they remembering the full nature of their experience in Egypt? No. But they are remembering, like, the onions and the leeks and the fish. Like, you just go down the Nile River and just throw it in a line and pluck it out. And so, like, it is. And they're in Goshen, right? There are all sorts of water sources in Goshen. They're actually living in a very prosperous land. And I'll tell you, I think I forget this sometimes. If you go back to Exodus 1, I want to show you something here that stuck out to me recently. In Exodus 1, do you remember when Pharaoh oppresses the people, what does he make them do? Yeah, and what was the work? What was the slavery work they had to
do?
Yeah, they built cities, they made bricks. That's what I always thought. And that's true. That's what Exodus 1 says in verse 11, heavy burdens, make the store cities. But I want you to keep looking in verse 13. They ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves and made their lives bitter with hard service and mortar and brick and in all kinds of work in the field. They were farmers, too. And going to the land of Goshen, you look around and compare it to the rest of Egypt. I mean, there's the Nile River, and it's gorgeous. It's green. Everywhere else is brown. Just brown is brown. I mean, tan. It's also tan. And some yellow, but mostly like yellow, brown, tan, brown. It's just brown and dead. It's brown because it's dead. And so you go to Goshen, and Goshen is just lush and vibrant and green and alive. And so they're used to being in this land where I don't think they're blowing things out of proportion. Let me ask you this. I don't want you to answer out loud. When you think through your relating of your story to the story of the Israelites and their exodus, which is what we're supposed to do, right? 1 Corinthians 10. This happened to them as examples for us. He's talking to Gentile, Greek-speaking people, you know, 1,500 years removed, totally different environment, and he says that happened to them so that you would learn something. Okay, so your story, if their story connected to Israel and Egypt, your story connects. And so if your slavery is sin and slavery to Satan, was it all bad? Don't answer out loud. I just want you to think. Was it all bad? Were all the things that you did in sin displeasurable? Inconvenient? Didn't some of them benefit you personally? Weren't there some good things about it? Let me ask it a different way. When Eve ate the fruit, were there good things about the fruit? She looked, she saw, it was a delight to the eyes, it would make her wise. It was good to eat, right? There were good things about it. But you can't deny the package. You go back and you read Exodus 1, it was hard labor. They were burdened. It was terrible. Later, Egypt is called the iron furnace, that God brought them out of the iron furnace. So, I don't know, I think it's important to remember that they're not making this up. They really did have access to all this good stuff. But where are they headed? Right now, in this moment in Numbers chapter 11, where are they headed? And how does God refer to the promised land? A land flowing with milk and honey. So they're only thinking about the right now moment. And they're not thinking about what's coming. And I tell you, that's what we've got to do. Sometimes we can only build on the experience of the past. What we've got to do is trust the promise of God for the future. Because we look back and we say, this was easier, this was better. And we sort of diminish the hard stuff, the bad stuff. And we say, but it had all these benefits. And we forget that the promise of God is free and it's glorious and it's good. And you've got to hold on and trust Him. Because you get out in that wilderness and it's more brown and tan and dead brown, yellow stuff. And it's hard. And there's no grass and there's no water except for what God miraculously provides for you. So trusting God is the only thing you're going to have to go on, but you got to keep going. All right, that's kind of an aside thing, but that just, recently I got back from Egypt and Jordan. And I'll tell you, it just stood out to me. Going to Goshen, we spent several days in Cairo, and it's just unpleasant. And then you go to Goshen, it's like, I get it. I understand why they wanted to come back here, because it was like a little oasis. It was like a little Garden of Eden paradise. And then God said, let's go, and takes them out into the wilderness. And it is hard desert living. But they're going to trust God to get them through and get them into the promised land. All right. Thoughts or questions about that idea?
Yeah, I think, I think with the slavery as well, it's familiar. It's familiar. And, you're in your comfort zone because you're just, even though it was hard, it was just something that you were just so used to doing for such a long time, that when you're removed from it, I don't know if we can say suddenly, but just when you're removed from that comfort and what you're used to, you're out of your comfort zone. You're out
right.
of, everything is unfamiliar, and it just really just speaks to, how much are you willing to sacrifice that comfort for something better, and really, even if you are willing to sacrifice that comfort,
right.
it's still a challenge, because again, you're just not in your comfort zone. You're not
right.
used to what you're doing, things that are unfamiliar, and so much is new.
Yeah, and God is providing. It's not like God's saying, "Come out here and starve, and just barely hang on until I get you into the land flowing with milk and honey." He's providing for them, and I guess that manna could have tasted like other stuff, but it's. It's good stuff. Okay. All right. One more observation. Meredith's translation, my translation also says that in verse 4, the rabble. Anybody else's translation say something different?
Mixed multitude.
In verse 4, mixed multitude. Okay. From Egypt, when they first left Egypt, it wasn't just Israelites that went with them. Again, you've got some of the Midianites with them. I don't think they're the problem necessarily. But there are also Egyptians that went with them. Now, I'm not saying these are all Egyptians. These may be some of these Israelites too. But you've got a group of people who aren't all on board with this God leading them into the promised land thing. It's a small group of people. And a small group of people complaining make big problems for God's people. If you can't work toward a solution, then complaining about your current circumstances doesn't really help. I'm not saying you have to provide a solution for every problem, but if you're not willing to work toward a solution, then complaining doesn't help. And two or three people in a congregation can poison the whole group. It doesn't take much. And I don't know if you've seen that at work before. I've seen it in my own family before, just in our small group of six, that if I'm having a bad day and I start to act in a pretty grumpy, let me use biblical words, in a bitter, envious, selfish, arrogant way. Not grumpy. Let's use the biblical words. Sinful way. It can make things rough for everybody. And pretty soon we're all complaining and grumbling until someone steps out and starts thanking God and praising God. All right. Other thoughts about that? Yes, sir.
What's interesting there is it says that they yielded to intense craving. So it may have been okay to have an intense craving for those things, right? But the fact that they yielded to it is really what caused the problem.
That's good, yeah. And that's going to come back to bite them
right.
later. Good, okay.
So that's how sin enters our lives,
yes.
right? We have a temptation, but we yield to it.
Right. Yeah, James 1. Right, the desire, and then we give into that, and suddenly that owns us. It turns around and eats us. All right, let's keep reading here. Let's look at 10 through 15. It doesn't just affect the people, but it begins to affect Moses some. Moses heard the people weeping throughout their clans, everyone at the door of his tent. And the anger of the Lord blazed hotly, and Moses was displeased. Moses said to the Lord, "Why have you dealt ill with your servant? And why have I not found favor in your sight that you lay the burden of all this people on me? Did I conceive all this people? Did I give them birth that you should say to me, 'Carry them in your bosom as a nurse carries a nursing child to the land that you swore to give to their fathers'? Where am I to get meat to give to all this people? For they weep before me and say, 'Give us meat that we may eat.' I am not able to carry all this people alone. The burden is too heavy for me. If you'll treat me like this, kill me at once. If I find favor in your sight, that I may not see my wretchedness." What's happened to Moses?
He's breaking down.
Yeah, I think that's a good way. He's breaking down. What else do you see happening here? Yeah, he feels burdened by the people. Did Moses want to save the Israelites? I think so. Like when he's 40 years old, I think Moses has in mind, I'm going to save these people. And then things don't go so well. So by the time he's 80, like that dream is lost. But it has been revitalized. He's gone into Egypt. He's seen Pharaoh brought low, the 10 plagues, crossing of the Red Sea. He's had experience with God on the mountain. I mean, Moses is all on board here. Let's lead the people in. But he sees the people are stiff-necked. He's had to save them a few times from God's wrath. And he's just tired. And he's beginning to think maybe this wasn't such a good idea after all. What do you notice about God in this scenario? Now look carefully. What do you see about God? What does God not do? It may be easier to ask. He doesn't say, "Excuse me, Moses," and just like, "You're done. Joshua, come up, you know, man on deck." He doesn't do that. What else do you see about God? How is God feeling about this whole scenario? God's angry and Moses is angry. Now, Moses is taking it personally. I think that is often the challenge of God's people. Do you remember when the people in 1 Samuel, they asked God for a king? And Samuel is upset. He feels like the people have rejected who? Samuel feels like people have rejected
him.
That's what God says. But God has to tell Samuel, they've not rejected you. I think Samuel's feeling some personal rejection here. They've not rejected you, but they've rejected me from being king over them. And a lot of times we're upset about the right things, but maybe for the wrong reasons. Maybe for personal reasons. But God is patient with Moses, and he's going to guide Moses through this, and he's going to give Moses relief. He's going to let Moses know this is not all on you. These are my people, and I'm going to provide leaders. Moses is dispensable, okay? Moses is not the only one that God can use to provide for the people, okay? Other things you notice through verse 15. David? I'm sorry, yeah. Other things through verse 15. All right, then let's look at 16 through 30 and see the solution to this. Oh, Elijah?
What's the difference between Moses? It seems like he's complaining through verse 11, through verse 15, and then the people in verse 4, 5, and 6. What's the difference between that?
That's a good question. In Philippians, Paul tells the saints there to do all things without grumbling or complaining. But have you read the Psalms? Does the psalmist ever complain? All over the place. There's a difference between complaining and complaining to God. And the people here, I think, are just grumbling and complaining and having a bitter attitude, and is poisoning the whole group. Moses has actually taken his complaint to God. And as he's speaking as respectfully as maybe he could or should, we'll let God decide. But he's having this conversation with God because, well, what does that express about Moses? If he's complaining to God, what does that say is going on inside Moses?
He sees God as being the one
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's faith, right? It's this conviction that God can handle my problems. So going to God and bringing your complaints is not a bad thing when you trust him to provide the solution. Now, his whole thing like, if this is the way you're going to treat me, God, just kill me now. Well, that's maybe a little too far. But are you ever, do you ever exaggerate in your complaints? I'm sorry? Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And, you know, I struggle with that. Like, you shouldn't vent, but don't you ever feel like, I just need to like let somebody know how I feel. It's not just the facts of it. God can handle the feelings, too. Okay, I think that gets to what you're asking. Other responses to that? Okay.
I was just going to say, it just shows that God is willing to listen.
Yes, excellent. Yeah, God is willing to listen to Moses' complaint. Now, Israel's making it hard for Moses to lead, but Moses is looking to God to help him lead. All right, let's look at 16 through 30. Then the Lord said to Moses, gather for me 70 men of the elders of Israel, whom you know to be the elders of the people and officers over them, and bring them to the tent of meeting, and let them take their stand there with you, and I will come down and talk with you there. And I will take some of the spirit that is on you and put it on them, and they shall bear the burden of the people with you. So that you may not bear it yourself alone. And say to the people, consecrate yourselves for tomorrow, and you shall eat meat. For you have wept in the hearing of the Lord, saying, who will give us meat to eat? For it was better for us in Egypt. Therefore the Lord will give you meat, and you shall eat. You shall not eat just one day, or 2 days, or 5 days, or 10 days, or 20 days, but a whole month, until it comes out at your nostrils and have wept before him, saying, why did we come out? Oh, excuse me. Nostrils, and becomes loathsome to you because you've rejected the Lord who is among you and have wept before him, saying, why did we come out of Egypt? But Moses said, the people among whom I am number 600,000 on foot, and you have said, I will give them meat that they may eat a whole month. Shall flocks and herds be slaughtered for them and be enough for them? Or shall all the fish of the sea be gathered together for them and be enough for them? The Lord said to Moses, is the Lord's hand shortened? Now you shall see whether my word will come true for you or not. So Moses went out and told the people the words of the Lord, and he gathered 70 men of the elders of the people and placed them around the tent. Then the Lord came down in the cloud and spoke to him and took some of the spirit that was on him and put it on the 70 elders. And as soon as the spirit rested on them, they prophesied. But they did not continue doing it. Now two men remained in the camp, one named Eldad and the other named Medad, and the spirit rested on them. They were among those registered, but they had not gone out to the tent. And so they prophesied in the camp, and a young man ran and told Moses, Eldad and Medad are prophesying in the camp. And Joshua, the son of Nun, the assistant of Moses from his youth, said, my lord Moses, stop them. But Moses said to him, are you jealous for my sake? Would that all the Lord's people were prophets, if the Lord would put his spirit on them. And Moses and the elders of Israel returned to the camp. All right, so God's got this plan. He's going to provide meat for them. And what is his aim with giving them meat? Besides just feeding them, what's he going to do with them? Make them sick of it. What does the text say? I mean, that's right, but the meat is going to come out their nose. Does that sound like satisfaction to you? Joanna says, no, that's not so good. It's just like eating ice cream and ice cream and ice cream and ice cream until you puke, right? Like it's just too much. It's too much. Why would God do such a thing? And what lesson would that be? Okay, be content, be grateful. But I think there's something else going on here too. Amos?
It's also like when they hunted the king and they killed the king, and he said that the king shall rule over you.
Okay.
He would
do. Good. Good, good, good. That's a good observation. The things that we want so much that they master us, they make bad masters. Right? This meat is going to become their master. David?
It reminds me of that the message of Ecclesiastes. You think this is what you need? Okay, I'll give you all of it. You're going to see that this is not exactly what you need.
Okay, good. Good. Lynn?
Same idea as David. I'm thinking about what's the message where he gives them over to their lust and their desires.
Romans 1, yes, yes.
I think that's repeated throughout Scripture so many times, where God is trying to convince them of the goodness of himself, and they're just set on what they want. And he eventually gets to a point where he goes, okay, I'll give you what you want, and you'll see that it is not going to satisfy you.
Part of their complaining, too, is thinking... Isn't it thinking that God can't provide for them? And God's about to show them, oh yeah, I can provide for you. And it's going to be provided so much that there's no doubt what God can do. This isn't just a casual flock of birds that's going to come in. It is going to be a miraculous show of God's power. So a lot of things happening here. But there's something else. It's not just providing the meat. Moses is really struggling here. Where are you going to get all this meat? Which, by the way, reminds us of what other story where someone says, let's feed the people, and someone else says, where are we going to get enough food to feed all these people? Even if we had so much food, we never could feed so much people. And he says, you just watch and wait and see. What does that remind you of?
Feed the 5,000.
Yeah, in John 6, right? And of course there, Jesus is going to say that God gave you bread from heaven, but that wasn't even real bread. He gave you, you know, the manna. Here's the true bread from heaven. And he's talking about himself, the thing that really satisfies. They're going to eat bread, they're going to eat quail, and it's not going to satisfy them, but Jesus does satisfy. So there's a little link, okay? So write you a note in there, if you would, for John 6, if you want. But the other thing here is that he provides Moses some helpers. 70 of the elders are going to come together, and God is going to show that he's with them, to help them. They're not going to be prophets, if you will, but he's going to allow them to prophesy for a time. Two of the guys don't show up. This is kind of interesting. I don't really know what to make of this, so if you have ideas, I'd love to hear what you're thinking about this. But two guys, it seems, reject the summons. You know, their attitude may not be very good, and so they stay in the camp rather than go with Moses to receive God's help. But God, you know, God can work through people like that still. And so he sends his spirit on Medad and Eldad, and they begin to prophesy. And Moses' response to this is that would that all God's people could be prophets, were prophets, which also points to the new covenant, I think. Joel 2, God's going to pour out his spirit on all flesh. It's this idea that God wants to work through all of his people. Right now he's working through some individual leaders. But God's not limited by the kind of people he can use. God can use rebellious people to do his will. But he wants to use people who are submissive and willing to do his will. It's a really interesting story. I'm not sure what all to make of it. Thoughts or, I mean, insights to this? David?
It really reminds me of the apostles, when they somehow see someone casting out demons, and they go to Jesus and say, hey, should we stop them?
Right.
They have this jealousy. And then Jesus turns around and says, you know, they're not against us. They're not against us. They're for us. Moses has this same attitude of meekness, and then we're going to see that even in chapter 12.
Yes,
he's the meekest man. So these are chapters that are showing his meekness, his humility, and then I love how this shows them the greatest need that these people have is the Spirit of God upon them. It's perfect for setting this up for the New Testament ideas of the spirit versus the flesh.
Yes.
The spirit versus the flesh. What is it that we really need? Yeah. Focus on the spirit. That's what you really need.
Yeah, and there's something maybe that points to 1 Corinthians 14. Paul talks about there with supernatural gifts. They all wanted tongues because they thought it would make them something. It was pride and selfishness that was leading them there. And Paul says, you know, if you desire spiritual gifts, desire to prophesy. It builds up God's people. So they're complaining, they're tearing each other down, and Moses is saying, with God's help, we can build each other up. I don't know. It's some interesting things here. Other thoughts? All right, let's look into the miracle itself. In 31 through 35, we'll read this and then we'll have to to close up for the day. Then a wind from the Lord sprang up. Now notice, where'd the wind come from? From the north, the south, the east, the west. From the Lord. The direction doesn't matter. God's taking care of this, okay? The wind sprang up from the Lord, and it brought quail from the sea and let them fall beside the camp. About a day's journey on this side and a day's journey on the other side around the camp, and about 2 cubits above the ground. And the people rose all that day and all night and all the next day and gathered the quail. Those who gathered least gathered 10 homers, and they spread them out for themselves all around the camp. While the meat was yet between their teeth, before it was consumed, the anger of the Lord was kindled against the people, and the Lord struck down the people with a very great plague. Therefore, the name of the place was called Kibroth Hattaava, because there they buried the people who had the craving. From Kibroth Hattaava, the people journeyed to Hazeroth, and they remained at Hazeroth. Kibroth Hattaava means what? Graves of craving. Back to our point about James 1. The things that we want, you do what you do because you want what you want. And so their craving, their lust, their desire has destroyed them. It's mastered them. Why would God send such, I mean, he's such power to bring them the meat, and then why send the plague? Lyndon? Do you think God notices ingratitude? What should have been the result of this was praise, worship, thankfulness, and instead it's just eating and eating and eating and eating. And God sees this and punishes them for it. They didn't need the meat so much as they needed to recognize God as the giver of all good things. And so when they only saw the meat and failed to see God, God was jealous so much that he sent this great plague. Amos? Yeah. Their focus is right here in front of them rather than on God. David, you had a thought?
Just thinking about that, I have not appreciated how much each person is gathering for himself.
Right. The least 10 homers. Yeah.
What is that?
I did it the other day, but like a homer is like over 200 liters. And so 2,000 liters of quail, each person.
And so each person is not just trying to, okay, I'm going to get what I need. I'm really hungry. I'm going to go out and get what I need. Thank you, Lord. It's, we're going to pack this up.
Stockpile all the quail.
It's hoarding. It's yes. Not just gathering what you need. It's hoarding.
Right. Yeah. You remember the story in Luke with the 10 lepers? And they all cry out, you know, Son of David, have mercy on us. And he sends them away. And on their way to offer for the priest, they're cleansed of their leprosy. How many come back? One comes back. And what does Jesus say? Were there not 10 of you? Does Jesus notice ingratitude? Yeah. God's people should be a thankful people. And we, more than anyone, have reason to thank God. Our desires, when we begin to chase after them so much that we sin in order to get it, or sin when we don't get it, it's really saying that I don't trust God to provide for me. I'm not grateful for what he's already given me in Christ. I don't see that every blessing that I need is already mine in Christ. It's a faithless response. Ingratitude is a faithless response. Amos? When is lunch? I'm so hungry. What are we going to eat? We had that yesterday. Rah, 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 rah. And I'm just not even thanking God. Yeah. You know something about that? Okay. All right. So we'll take about a 10-minute break. Thanks for everyone's help in discussing this. And we'll pick up, God willing, next Sunday in Numbers 12. Okay. We'll just try to take the slow pace walking through these travel sections. Thank you, brother.